everybody, it's Will Schreiner here, and welcome to the Chronic Comedy Podcast, presented by HealthPure. It's such a treat and a thrill to have as my first guest, Ant. Yes, his name is Ant, and you know him from 5 seasons on Last Comic Standing. He was the host of VH1's Celebrity Fit Club. He's got DVDs, CDs, STDs, you name it. He's got his own podcast called Second Chances, How to Turn Your Life Around. Tours the world. We got a chance to sit down in the Marriott VIP Lounge, as he likes to call it, to talk a little bit about his career.
I'm sitting here in the Marriott Lounge, and you are a preferred member. Did you say you have perks? Is that why we
I'm
have
I'm a platinum member.
You're a platinum member. So does this lounge really make it all worth the travel?
So I got to travel anyway. So Kathleen Madigan, the genius that she is, said, Aunt, focus all of your travel on one airline and one hotel chain, and you will get their status, and they will treat you well. So on American Airlines, I'm an executive platinum.
Right. Well, when you get off a plane in Florida, what does it feel like? A wheelchair store.
It's a wheel. It's like literally I've walked into a medical supply store. It's just so funny. I saw a lady today with 2 service dogs in this lounge.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have 2 service dogs. You can only have one.
Well,
you can only have one.
What if you have split personality?
Okay, yeah, she could have 2. One for each one.
Yeah. But now, you know, you have had such a great career, and I mean, you've done everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you deal with... humor. How do you think people can use humor to help in their own wellness and their own compliance to being healthy?
Well, I suffer from addiction is my probably most life-threatening thing, mm-hmm. which is a constant life-threatening. I'm a former heroin junkie, crystal meth addict, and alcoholic. So for me, talking about it, one reminds me that I have this disease that wants to kill me all the time. Because alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease that tells you you don't have it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it tells you you don't have it. So to treat it, which is why so many people go to 12-step meetings, so many people go to rational recovery, Buddhist recovery, whatever it is, to continually remind them that they have it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a society that tells you, oh, you could just have one, or you haven't drank for 5 years, you could just have one now.
Right, yeah.
Well, you know, you wouldn't tell somebody with cancer, well, you've done your chemo for 3 of the 6 weeks, just don't go for the next week.
Right,
you just
right.
don't do that.
How do you treat addiction, though? How is it different between alcohol and heroin and say, Oxy or any of the other sort of...
For me, this is just my own opinion.
Right.
For me, you treat them the same.
You do.
It's, I work a program of recovery that involves a spiritual component, a service component, a fellowship component, and then the actually doing, you know, a few writing assignments, basically,
right.
and taking an inventory. So it's trusting God, helping others, and cleaning house. That's basically the way that my program works. And for me, the humor of it is I'm not going to let it beat me down, which is why as a comedian, I like talking about being an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I like talking about being a former junkie. I like talking about how junkies are so entitled,
right.
too. You know,
right.
I volunteer at a treatment facility, and we've got these junkies that come in, and they're literally at death's door. You know, and the chef puts a meal out, and they're like, I'm gluten-free. You were shooting toilet water in the bathroom 5 minutes ago. When did you start being so concerned about your health?
Yeah, just now.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
is
yeah.
there a pool? There's no pool.
Yeah.
You were living behind the dumpster at Jack in the Box. There was no pool there either. A cesspool.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, I love looking for the humor in that because there's a relatability in that. And to audiences who aren't familiar with it, it humanizes us.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people have the misconception about alcoholics and junkies. They think that we're forever that we're not capable of change.
Right, right.
And there's a negative stigma.
But
so
they've thrown their life out in some day. And the realization that you have the ability to fix it is what a lot of people are in denial
are
about.
Are in denial about.
Right.
Absolutely. So I think that as comedians, we take the temperature of America. We take the temperature of the globe,
sure.
I think. We really do. And I think as comedians, we have a responsibility to sort of use what's happening in our world, in our lives, and sort of bring it out there and make it understandable in a way. Now, I'm not saying all comedians have to educate an audience or
do anything like that.
But I'm saying that we have a responsibility, I think, to make the world a better place than when we left it through laughter.
Sure, sure.
You know?
And awareness. I mean, that's the big thing that we're doing at the Chronic thing, is trying to make people aware of their condition to do
exactly.
something about it. If I talk in my act about getting my prostate checked, I got 10 new minutes about it, but I also tell people you're 50 and you got to get it done.
I just went in for my colonoscopy,
yeah.
and I got to tell you, it was not bad. bad at all. I went in and the doctor goes, okay, we're going to sedate you now. There's two types of sedation. You can go completely under, or we can put you in twilight sleep.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I said, doc, why would anybody want the twilight sleep? And then he points to the giant flat screen television on the wall. And he said, because I'm going to see the procedure on that screen if you want to watch it with me. And I'm like, doc, I love being on camera.
Yeah.
But this is a bit much for me. Yeah. I go, I'll take the completely going under.
Yeah. Is that why you had makeup?
Right? I was like...
Yeah, no, I do a joke about going to get my prostate check, and there's a discount guy who used an iPhone. You know, which people, everybody laughs, you know. And I said, in the middle of it, Siri started talking.
That's hilarious.
But that's funny. But I think that that's our goal in what we're doing, is to make people aware. When you talk about your addiction on stage, do you bring out...
All the time, people come up to me after the show.
And they're curious.
Usually it's loved
ones
will come to me and say, you know, I'm really worried about my husband or my son or my daughter or my wife. And once in a while, I'll get somebody that comes up to me and says, you know, you talk about this 20-question test that tells you if you're an alcoholic or suggests you might be.
And I copied off a guy on that test.
You cheated, right?
Yeah.
And they ask about it, you know, and I carry some with me because it's my responsibility as a sober man to help other people achieve sobriety if they choose it.
Is that part of the goal of the program? Is to bring others?
Not to bring others in like a cult,
but
my primary purpose is to stay sober and help someone else struggling with addiction. That is my primary purpose. Mm-hmm. It is my purpose above comedy. It is my purpose above my family. It is above my purpose above my friends, having fun, money. It is my primary purpose.
Mm-hmm. So before I was a stand-up comedian, I was a flight attendant. One time we had a member of the Indian royal family flying on board one of our jets. The royal family spent $31,000 buying every single first class cabin seat. She looks at me and she goes, I'll have you know, in my country, I'm a princess. I order people around. That is so freaking cool, because in America, I am a queen and I outrank you.
Your move towards being funny.
Yeah, so I thought I could do it better and I could actually uplift a community without denigrating one.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing it. I started doing it. And at the time, I was a flight attendant working for an airline, and I used to do bits.
Oh,
on
you're one
the
of those.
Airplane.
Yeah.
Before Southwest Airlines,
on the wing. Yeah,
I would say there may be 50 ways to leave your lover, but there are only 8 ways to exit this aircraft.
Yeah.
So you might want to put your paper down and pay attention, unless you're going through a divorce, ladies, then hand your husband the paper. You know,
perfect.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would do things like that. And then.
And did you get applause? Because I remember the clever announcements, people would applaud at the end of it.
I used to get thunderous applause.
Yeah.
Thunderous.
Yeah,
like,
no.
And the best part about it is I didn't really know that I was going to become a comedian. I just knew that after seeing that guy doing that, I thought, you know what? I wonder if I could. So I just started doing it just to think, you know, and then I started getting the applause. And then, you know, once you hear laughter and applause, you're hooked. It's like a drug.
I was going to say exactly that. I mean, and I say that all the time to young comics. I said, when you start to kill,
you will never leave this business. We own you.
And even when you bomb, you have to find, I always found something rewarding in bombing, you know.
It's not my favorite thing, but I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah.
Because I learn more from bombing than I do from killing.
Right.
Because when I bomb, I get to go back and either, if I recorded my set, which I don't record all of them anymore, but most of them, I get to go back and I get to look over that set and say, wow, did I add an extra word to this joke that wasn't there before? Was the pause in the wrong place? Mm-hmm. Was I rushing through the joke? Did I not give the audience enough time to hear the setup? Was the setup unclear? Was the punchline not clear?
Mm-hmm.
And I get to really review jokes, because I write a lot on stage too.
Me too. I mean, I like, that's why I like talking to a crowd, because something will come out of
something will always when we were young, we would watch each other and go, hey, I got a tag for you, or you might want to think about this bit, or, you know. And every other sentence when you hang out with comics is, you should write that down.
Well, let's talk about people that need help. How do you convince them to get it?
Because they don't. Part of what makes my program work so well is it's a program of attraction and not promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So people will look at me and say, why are you so happy? Or why does your life seem to be going so much better? And then when they come to me, that's the attraction. Then I get to say, you know, I was a junkie and an alcoholic and my life was falling apart. My partners were leaving me. I was cheating on people left and right. I wasn't filing my taxes. My family was mad at me. I go, and then all of a sudden I started doing a few simple things. I took a few simple suggestions. I started getting plugged in spiritually and my life got better. That's it. And then they're either going to say, can you help me?
Right.
Or can you point me in the right direction? In which case the answer is always yes. Or they're not.
Do you think the spirituality is an essential part of it?
Yeah, but I think people misunderstand what that means about spirituality. So many people take that to mean the word God.
Right.
And spirituality isn't really that. Spirituality just means, is it possible that there's something happening outside of you that is more powerful than you?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So for me, you know, I remember when I first got sober, Hurricane Andrew was ripping through Florida. So that's a power greater than me mm-hmm. that I can totally succumb to and millions succumb. So for me, it's that. For some people, it's the wind. For some people, it's the ocean. Some people, it's God. Some people, it's the universe. Some people, it's energy. Whatever it is, but so long as it, and this is just my opinion, I think that for recovery to work, there has to be some sort of surrender. And the first surrender is you have to realize that your addiction is more powerful than you.
Right. It has control over you.
It has control because alcoholism made every decision for me. Alcoholism decided if I went to college or not went to college. It decided if we were going to be friends or not, because if you didn't drink like I did, we weren't going to be friends.
Right.
It decided if we were going to date. It decided where I was going to live. It made all my and looking back now, mm-hmm. hindsight is what why I'm able to see that. So it's about attraction and not promotion, because if I'm promoting this,
right.
I'm selling you something. I'm a snake oil salesman. Mm-hmm. But if I'm just living my life and doing good things and helping other people and my life is getting better and your life isn't,
right.
you're going to come to me and go, mm-hmm. wow, what's going on here? And then my job, and it's an honor, is to tell you this is what's going on and this is how I did it. And then it's a gift that's laid at your feet. It is.
Yeah.
This is how I did it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lay this at your feet. And if you want to pick it up, I'm here to help and I'll go the distance with you. And if you don't, no harm, no foul.
Is there a commonality of how people did it? Is there a common, realization that they came to make that decision that they want to change their lives? I think so.
Yeah. It's called a bottom. And for me, the bottom is some people go, well, you hit your bottom when you stop digging. And I don't think that that's really the case, because I think the disease is so powerful that it wants you dead. It'll settle for miserable, it wants you dead.
Yeah.
For me, a bottom is when the consequences the consequences of your using become worse than the pleasure you derive from the behavior.
The short-term pleasure. Yeah.
So for me, it was when my sister and my family said, you no longer have a family, and they threatened to call the police on me if I showed up at the christening of my baby sister's child.
Mm-hmm.
That was a consequence I was unwilling to accept, and that's when I decided I need help.
So you decide, as opposed to intervention where people decide for you, intervention seems to be a fairly unsuccessful.
I'd say the intervention's about 50-50.
Is it 50-50? Yeah.
They're about 50-50 because what happens is because I'm a certified interventionist.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
What happens in an intervention is a person has sufficiently burned their life to the ground that the family typically sees where that's headed,
right.
and they step in and they present irrefutable evidence to their loved one of this is where your life is headed. And the reasons why interventions work, because typically the person who is the recipient of the intervention is going to have a moment of clarity,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to drop their defenses. And they're going to look at what was just presented to them, and they're either going to own it and get honest, in which case they have a chance, or they won't.
Well, now, if somebody, I said the other day, if somebody doesn't want to take care of themselves and face their issue,
mm-hmm.
will they, what do you have a technique for that? Because I think
it's not really a technique, really. It's just, for me, if I see someone that's struggling, I just say to them, hey, you know what? I've been where you are, mm-hmm. and my life is completely different now. And if you ever need any help, you come see me.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
And you plant a seed. That's mm-hmm. all you can do, because if they don't want it for themselves, it doesn't matter how hard you force. It's not going to work.
Right.
They've got to want it.
Yeah, that's what I, if he doesn't want it, you know, yeah, if you, if in the case of this friend of mine, if he doesn't, and he's been living this, I'm okay for 35 years. No, he's not okay. And it's about to come to a type personality.
Oh, and it's going to, what's going to happen is there's going to be a consequence because the consequences are getting greater. People are leaving him. Family is now noticing. People are getting worried. People are commenting to him. And those are all important.
Right.
But one of the big consequences are an arrest. Someone very dear to him leaves in a way that is, very ultimatumish, but it's typically, there will be a consequence he will face, and he will be faced with making a change, and he will either get honest with himself, which is the most important thing, which is, wow, I do have a problem. And then magic happens or he won't, and he'll end up dead or in jail.
And you think therapy can be a way around that? I mean, it can be an insight to what you need to do to make.
I think
change.
A really good therapist helps because really good therapists also say you need a program of recovery, and therapy doesn't provide a program of recovery. All therapy does is illustrate back to you or mirrors back to you what your life is based on things that you say. So a good therapist will say, based on what you're saying, it sounds like you might need either a 12-step program or rational recovery or, go to, Buddhist recovery or whatever it is. Right. I'm assuming we're talking recovery.
Yeah.
So a good therapist will suggest that. Most therapists will say, I won't even see you again until you go to a 12-step meeting.
Right.
Most of the really well-trained ones, that's sort of the way that they do it.
Yeah. I've gone to couples therapy a couple times, and in both cases, they said, you two should not be together.
But why didn't you listen?
I said, these are old girlfriends, old relationships.
Yeah.
Where they were right. We were not good for each other.
There's this great saying I heard, and it said, people will show you who they are, believe them the first time.
Yeah.
And for some reason, as human animals, we don't ever want to believe that. Like I was with somebody who was abusive. Mm-hmm. They showed me who they were, and I didn't want to believe it.
Yeah. Or you think you can change them.
That's the other big thing, that humans, our egos are so big.
I'm going to be.
And how many people have you actually ever changed?
No. And I'm at my age, I ain't changing. I'm happy with who I am, and that's a battle that I have.
But I think the idea that you ain't changing is probably a battle you're not going to win, because eventually, whatever it is that's not working for you in your life, and I don't know if there's anything working or not working in your life, but it is going to always be there, because what you resist persists.
Right. Yeah.
Will, you brought up the ex-girlfriend. I mean, if you look back, over the, I always like to call it the wreckage of our past. But if you look back over it, the one common denominator is who?
Yeah.
It's you.
You.
Right. So, that's one of the things that for me, my program is always somebody once said to me, Aunt, do you ever notice in every single shitstorm, the same one person seems to always be around? Right. And I was like, oh, because I was going to say my mom, it's me. I'm the common denominator. So until I can start looking at me and my behavior and stop being a victim and blaming everybody else,
blame seems to be the biggest.
It's the big
thing.
Well, you're the person that you and I are talking about speaks victimese.
Yeah, sure.
He speaks victimese. Yeah. It's not his fault. It's her, or it's or it's the family, or if it's not enough money, or it's the work schedule, but it's never going to be the drinking, or the drugging. It's never going to be that.
Well, it's funny about drinking. Our friend that's going through a cleanse says, people don't like to be around me when I'm not drinking. And I said, that's a horrible way to think. He said, people think I'm more fun and I'm more funny when I'm drinking. And I'm like,
I didn't believe that, because I thought he was very funny and very charming and very personable. Yeah. And he wasn't drunk.
No. And he is. But he has this.
That's an old idea. What happens is what's called a societal construct. Yeah. Society tells you, loosen up, marketing does.
Sure.
Take the edge off. Well, you're the edge. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to take off? You're the edge. Just alcohol's not going to take the edge off anything. Well, I mean, seriously, I'm friends with Cher. Mm-hmm. And Cher one time, because I said, you've never been embroiled in a drug scandal or, and I'm like, why? And she's like, I've never seen drugs or alcohol do anything good for anybody.
Right, yeah.
And when you think about that,
yeah.
It hasn't.
No, it really hasn't done it. The only quote that I think it's Dorothy Parker. She says, "Why do you drink?" He says, "I drink to make other people interesting."
They drink to make other people interesting.
And I said, that's the only sort of positive quote I could think about alcohol.
And see, for me, I drank because I wanted to black out.
Yeah. Oh, you. Yeah.
That's it. I drank people. I was never a social drinker. I never went out for just one. I went out because I wanted to get blotto and I wanted to black out. Mm-hmm. And then what happened for me is those consequences got dire. Like I would wake up with women and that's horrifying for me. And they'd usually be crying. And one time I'm like, "Why are you crying?" And she was like, "How drunk was I?" I'm like, "Honey, I am a catch. I don't know what you're, how rude," you know? And I woke up in Chicago and don't even know how I got there. And I started in LA. Uh-huh. So, but that wasn't enough to get me to quit. Mm-hmm. You know, instead my head said, "Well, you should just switch to cocaine and then you won't be waking up with girls."
Right. In that period of our lives, there was Quaaludes, there was cocaine.
Remember
there was,
Quaaludes?
Oh, Quaaludes.
See, young kids today don't get the benefit of the stuff we had. That's chloral hydrates.
Yeah, mushrooms.
We had mushrooms, like you know, all of grown that, by Indians.
Yeah, all of that stuff. I remember peyote for the first time was one of the
And you met your maker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was
one of the most, you know, I felt, geez, I have this new insight.
I have an insight into the universe I've never had before. Yeah. But then when you sober up, then the rational brain chimes in and says, was any of that real or was it a chemical reaction in this brain that created all that? I remember the first time I took LSD, I was watching Popeye the Sailor Man and Bluto was giving me launch codes. Was that real?
Yeah.
You know, do we encode launch codes? We don't. But I thought it was real at the time.
Well, that is the beauty of comedy is that you can, I mean, the jester can say anything to the king.
Anything.
As long as there's a twist or
it's got to be funny
behind the message.
Right.
But I talk about in my corporate speaking about after laughter is the height of listening.
Yep.
And people will listen when you make them laugh because they'll pay attention.
Because they will pay attention.
Yeah.
It is the it's also the gift of healing. It's like they say every time you have a belly laugh, you add 7 minutes of lifespan to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, Margaret Cho gave me the best advice ever and it suited my career. She goes, "Look, go out. Right. And just know you're open and get them." She goes, "And in the middle, tell them whatever it is you want them to know."
Right.
"And then finish strong."
Yeah.
So I have always used that formula of just I go out strong. I've got my strong opens. I know what they are. In the middle is where I take the risks.
Sure. Yeah.
And this is where I'm going to, like last night, I tried some new jokes about my dog and about racism. And, you know, I try and sort of illustrate how subtle racism exists in all of us. And for me, it was through my dog. And the joke worked, and I couldn't believe that it worked because, you know, it's only the third time I've done it, and the first two times I did it was at an open mic, and you can never, you know, you just never know.
Well, yeah, and was it a good crowd, a bad crowd? Because there is a curse of a new joke, getting a laugh, never working again.
Ever. And I make a point of telling an audience that. I go, "I hope that was a genuine laugh, because if this bombs on The Tonight Show, I'm going to come back to this moment, and I'm remembering what all your faces look like."
Yeah, yeah. Stephen Wright, when he was here, and he says, "I have a new joke. I do it five times. If it doesn't work four out of five times, I throw it out."
Four out of five, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I will do a joke for 30 days. And if at the end of the 30th day, I'm not comfortable enough with it enough that I'm willing to lead with it, I'll toss it.
Our podcast is brought to you by HealthPure. HealthPure intends to help consumers make sense of their own healthcare environment. An informed decision will help motivate the user to take positive actions in their own healthcare and wellness.
If you had told me, "Aunt, you will never do heroin again for the rest of your life," I would not have entered the program. I would have said, "Forget it." But instead they said, "Just for today, don't do it. And then tomorrow make a different decision or the same decision." And I've just strung, you know, over 6 years of daily one-day decisions of, "I just don't want to do it today." So what I would say to people is do your preventative maintenance. Treat yourselves as well as you treat your dog, and you will be on the right path.
Okay. Aunt, always great to see you
in person.
Thanks for being on the show, and I hope we can have you with us on the Chronic.
I want to do it. Done.
Yeah.
Our first Chronic Comics Wellness Podcast with guest comedian Ant. HealthPure is a sponsor of the Chronic Comedy Tour. For more information, go to chroniccomics.com.